So, Nicholas, last time I spoke to you, you had just arrived in Alberta. You had just taken up the Translational Health Chair in Water, and you had quite a few things on the go. You're now 3 years into it. What would you say is a good status report?
Well, basically, we're very much on track, somewhat ahead in certain areas. We're working with the provincial government on regulatory reform of water services. So starting with drinking water, we're adding to that the ways to look at how we might manage the risks, which are the greatest risks now through pathogens in water services, which is through aerosols of organisms that grow in our premise plumbing. So we've built a premise plumbing facility to look at alternative, in fact, somewhat probiotic approaches to control those pathogens.
So when you say premises, you're talking about water that goes down our toilets or and into the sewer?
I'm talking about initially the drinking water that arrives to our buildings, so through our main conveyance systems, the distribution systems of drinking water, comes to us as very good quality clean water here in Alberta. But in our buildings, it can sit and stagnate in quite small diameter pipes where there's a lot of slime or biofilm on the walls of those pipes. And in certain cases, that can lead to growth of organisms like Legionella pneumophila and other respiratory pathogens. So when we turn on the shower, we can inhale or turn on our spa baths, we can inhale these sorts of pathogens through aerosols.
And what are we doing about it at this point?
At the moment, there are no regulatory constraints on these, what we call opportunistic pathogens, ones that can grow in these premise plumbing situations. Some hospitals are fairly proactive about looking for and managing their plumbing in their large healthcare facilities. But people at home, for example, who may have spa baths or holiday houses that are not used so often and sitting through the summer months, these sorts of organisms can grow in that sort of premise plumbing. And at the moment, we're not giving any guidance to either the general public and in some cases institutions about what are the best ways to minimize the exposure to these organisms and, quite frankly, in the first place, to stop them colonizing and growing in the plumbing of buildings.
What are some of the things that you've discovered so far?
The research side has been really quite fascinating. We're finding that plastic pipe, which is more commonly used now, like PVC and some cross-linked polyethylene or PEX pipe, creates a different microbiome than what we see on traditional pipe surfaces like copper pipe. And whilst there's less growth on copper pipe, less biofilm, I mean by that, we actually see that the organisms that grow there support Legionella, or appears to be the case, much more so than on plastic pipe. So we're looking at, can we have an upstream plastic pipe, we call it a selector, that selects for the right probiotic organisms to seed the downstream copper pipe in an existing, say, hospital or large school premise plumbing facility to see whether we can actually deliberately colonize it with preferential organisms that will suppress the growth of these opportunistic pathogens. Laboratory-wise, we have demonstrated that, and we're now building up to a sort of pilot-scale facility here in a brand-new laboratory that has just been built for this purpose.
So then the upstream that's coming from the drinking water facility into the house and downstream would be the sewer going out?
Mm. So the upstream side we're looking at in modifying the quality of that water rather than just throwing, for example, more chlorine or monochloramine, which is often used in hospitals to control Legionella. When we do that, we actually find, yes, Legionella may be controlled, but we then have an unintended consequence of that disinfectant, which is the growth of non-tuberculous mycobacteria that also cause wound and lung infections, particularly in healthcare settings. So more chlorine is not really the answer, hence why we're looking at this probiotic approach. But on the downstream side, all that water goes down the, if you like, down the sink and waistlines in buildings. And in the U-bends in those, we're finding they also get colonized by bacteria. And worse, they get colonized, particularly in healthcare settings, by antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And in multi-rise buildings, when you flush a toilet upstairs, there's some pressure waves that can pulse and aerosolize those resistant bacteria from the U-bends back into the ward of the hospital or the bathroom of that facility. And indeed, there have been classic examples now in Europe where antibiotic-resistant bacteria are chronically infecting people in the one room in a hospital environment, and it's realized that it's because it's coming from the U-bends, which are never cleaned out and never really maintained because people hadn't realized the nature of this risk pathway before.
We've been learning recently about our own intestines and how probiotics and bacteria, like what it is you're eating, affects how your health is and what comes out the other end. So essentially, this is almost the same thing for the plumbing going into the house.
Exactly. It's a very good analog. The human microbiome work of our gastrointestinal tract is exactly the same techniques that we're using to look at the microbiome of our premise plumbing system. And the same principles hold in that there is a healthy microbiome, and when things, for example, you take antibiotics and you upset your natural balance, and then organisms like Clostridium difficile, that's one example of a weed bacterium that will grow and chronically cause irritable bowel disease, we're seeing that our chlorination of waters actually is causing the same sort of scenario. It's upsetting the ecological balance that encourages the growth of some of these opportunistic pathogens. So that's in the drinking water side. And in the wastewater side, yes, we've got these zones that we've traditionally never thought about being a problem. All of this leads us, particularly on the waste side, to think about that our gravity sewer system is not a sensible approach. So there are, for example, toilets that are vacuum flush that most people may have come across on boats, on trains, and in aircraft. They are a very wise investment in a hospital because when you flush a toilet, you aerosolize whatever pathogens the person before had excreted to some degree into the air. So the next person coming into that room or facility will touch surfaces or breathe in the air with those pathogens. But with a vacuum flush toilet, only a half a litre or so of water is used, which saves water, and 60 litres of air is used to move that residual down the sewer. That's a much, much safer scenario. And so if we started to have these vacuum flush sewers and removing, therefore, our U-bends, because you no longer need those U-bends in that sort of configuration, we'd have a much safer, particularly in healthcare setting, waste management system. And the real benefit of all of that is not only in human health, but we can then recover the energy from that black water. And if we connected it to the kitchens, for example, the food residuals, it is a far more efficient way of recovering the embedded energy in that food and fecal residual, which, when we do the calculations, can supply more than the total amount of energy used to treat all drinking water and wastewater services in a community. So we're coming out net positive in energy recovery. And it even gets better, that the residual after we've stripped out the energy in the form of methane, we're left with ammonium and phosphorus, which are traditionally pollutants that we have to spend a lot of money and energy to remove. We can actually precipitate those because they're at a higher concentration and produce a fertilizer called struvite that can turn those nutrients back out to agriculture where they came from in the first place. So we get ahead even further by this separation of residual streams, the black water from the grey water, and having these vacuum type systems in premises, particularly in healthcare settings.
So I see the dollar signs, the economic side of it and the technology side of it. What would it take to make this changeover?
To make the change is really a multifaceted problem. And it's quite fascinating in that sense. It's part sociological in the sense of how people think about it. It's also very much driven by current regulatory frames and governance structures. So the way we're dealing with this conversion and rethinking is at multiple levels. So we're building an iconic development just here on the outskirts of Edmonton at St. Albert, where we're having our resource recovery centre. We're having that as an iconic thing. So it's somewhere where people are attracted to come and see and visit from school age all the way through to university and consulting engineers and others, so they can come and get a real feel for a full-scale operation of this type of technology. They can get a sense of the regulatory frames that need to be modified, which concurrently I'm working on with various provincial government regulators. And thirdly, we can work then with the consulting engineers who need to sort of build some faith that these systems are reliable and robust. So until we have this full-scale operational center, it's actually a very difficult thing. And this is, in fact, why around the world we don't see this transformation happening overnight. We do see it in certain locations in Germany, in the Netherlands, and in Sweden, where it's beginning to take hold. But because it is such a fundamental rethinking, it really needs to be attacked on many, many fronts and in a very deliberate, consistent way. And ultimately, we're working with social surveys to get a sense of, you know, where are Albertans today in their sense of reusing residual waters and nutrients? How do they feel about it? Do they think there's even a need to do so? So there are all these other pressures that end up ultimately being political pressure also. So our politicians will favour these sorts of alternatives because at the end of the day, we see that the cost is about half the conventional way that we manage water services. We end up with more energy being conserved, so we halve also nearly our greenhouse gas output and our carbon footprints. And quite frankly, it's a lot healthier and safer for communities to operate this way. So from all the main determinants of sustainability, from an economic perspective, from a human health perspective and environmental health perspectives, we're better off.
Now, you mentioned the word black water. I've heard of grey water. What's the difference between black water and grey water?
Great question. Well, black water is the toilet residual water. So when we flush the toilet, we call that the black water that goes down the drain. In some jurisdictions, and I like to include it also, the kitchen waste stream is also fairly rich in food residuals. And in fact, I would encourage the use of food waste disposal units because, again, from an energy point of view and an energy recovery, if we collect both the organics from the kitchen and the organics from the toilet, that's the best way to recover the nutrients and the energy and reduce the curbside pickup of compostables as well. So we actually have a more efficient way of collecting those residuals and making the most of them rather than curbside pickup, partial composting, and the rest going to landfill. So the black water is that composition, the toilet and the kitchen, and the grey is everything else in the household. So that's when we wash our bodies, we wash our clothes, we wash our dishes, all of that is grey water. We could compost it, and in fact, I worked on that many years ago as part of my PhD dissertation. But what we're looking at here is a more efficient option. We actually break it down in a process we call anaerobic digestion, which makes use of various microorganisms that ultimately turn organic matter, carbon, into methane. And then we can burn that methane and derive heat and all electricity directly from that combustion process. So we can maximize the amount of energy, if you like, conservation from the organics and turn that into usable heat and electricity. And that is much more efficient than composting, where we're basically using microbes just to aerobically turn that into carbon dioxide. So we're taking it to methane, which we can then burn and derive energy, which ultimately ends up as carbon dioxide, but with a much higher performance than what we get out of composting.
Thank you very much, Nicholas.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and I look forward to giving you another update in the near future. Thank you.